It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks to Sandy in Lake Geneva, who wants to make space to explore the lives of adults with autism. Also, Kylie in Sparta reached out seeking a program about autism as well. We learn about advances in research and supportive services for people with developmental disabilities. And you can call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Madeline Barger is a therapist and lead behavior analyst with the Waisman Center Autism Treatment Programs. Madeline, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Yes, and Megan Farley, your colleague, is here as well, psychologist, part of a team at the UW-Madison Waisman Center studying aging in autistic adults. Megan, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Well, Megan, let's start with you as you examine aging and autism. What are the central research questions your group is asking?
The thrust of this research project is to understand the natural course of autism throughout the lifespan into old age. And so we have an opportunity under the leadership of Janet Lanehart, who's a physician, a psychiatrist, and a wonderful researcher, to collect a huge amount of data from over 500 adults in three states who have autism. And so the real primary questions are about health and cognition, like dementia, heart health, and indicators that we can identify that will help predict the course for different individuals. So just really trying to understand how people age, what we can do to help them have, you know, the most successful lives possible. And in addition to those health measures, we're collecting a huge amount of data on a variety of other topics, including the characteristics of autism that the person exhibits, and then aspects of just their daily life and, you know, how they function and their quality of life and things like that.
Are there gaps in this understanding? I mean, is the research looking into the needs and the lifespan of autism? Are there missing pieces?
Oh, goodness, yes, yes. This is really groundbreaking research, unfortunately. I mean, folks with autism have been around for forever, but it's only been in the last 15 years or so that a lot of resources have gone into understanding how people with autism live and age into adulthood. And so you may be aware that research moves at a snail's pace compared to the course of actual life. So it's taking time to collect information that we can feel we can rely on to make decisions. And then it gets into people creating programs and policy development and finding what works and what doesn't work. So it's a slow moving thing. Meanwhile, people are living their lives. So the result is that we do have huge gaps. People with autism are grabbing the bull by the horns and creating their own communities. And they have been doing this online and supporting one another and doing a wonderful job with that. And then there are people, I work in private practice in the community. Madeline does a ton of work related to adults with autism. We have another colleague, Scott Allen, in the area who does a huge amount of work. So there are other people as well. And so there are not a lot of people, but a small number of people that are working really hard to try to build services and have better opportunities for people from the neurotypical perspective. Mm-hmm. Individuals with autism are doing their own thing, and then we're also working hard to try to provide support for them.
Yeah, thank you for that. And it really, it also makes you think about how the more the research is there, the more understanding, Madeline, of what services and support systems would be really helpful. Can you mm-hmm. talk about your work?
Yeah. So this is sort of the other side of the coin with what Megan's talking about is sort of applying the application of this type of research. So I often work with, I don't have an age limit, which is kind of rare in the autism world. I work with teens and adults all the way through the lifespan. And what I'm seeing is that services drop off after early childhood to school age. And so a lot of my work, I work with individuals, couples, and families, and we look at how can we adapt the environment to fit different neurology, and how can we sort of build relationships that will that will sustain people. Having challenges with intimacy or long-term relationships has a significant impact on mental health, and it's hard to sort of get out into the world and do those, access those things. For all the reason Megan and all the reasons Megan's talking about, all the gaps in sort of services and care. So a lot of the work that I do is also training clinicians, because we can sort of have a deep understanding and direct sort of relationship with a lot of adults on the spectrum. But they, if they don't have anywhere to go, that's really tricky. So we're doing a lot of trying to train really skilled mental health clinicians to work with different neurology, which means adapting some of the methodology we might use in therapy. We adapt it for different brains and different learners. And that's, it's hugely important to be able to do that, because otherwise we aren't able to apply all this, all the things we're learning in research.
Madeline Barger there, a therapist and lead behavior analyst at the Weizmann Center. We have Megan Farrelly, who is a psychologist, researcher studying aging and autism. You can join in questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. And Madeline, what does care look like for neurodivergent people in Wisconsin across different age ranges when maybe services are thin in specific areas or outside of metro areas?
Yeah, so as I had mentioned, there are more choices for early intervention, which could be more intensive or comprehensive treatment. So when somebody gets to middle school or high school, there are fewer choices. So there are autism clinics where they provide focused support. But what we're finding in mental health treatment is that we need to be, as Megan alluded to also, we need to be asking, not assuming. We have to ask the consumer. We have to ask the people who we're serving what they need. So a lot of adults on the spectrum are telling us that they need, just like all of us, relationships, reliable mental health support, support in the community or at work, and not necessarily a focus on maybe not focusing on skill deficit, but focusing on strengths and thinking about how can we change the world and the environment to make this person more comfortable rather than always focusing on changing a person. So I think that that's the big need is just support.
And Megan, in the research, I wonder as well, how important are the family caregivers who have been there through the lifespan, who have the knowledge of that loved one and caring for perhaps the, you know, them as a child and now they're an adult? What, you know, what do you see from the family caregivers through the research?
Family caregivers are tremendously important. We can't do the research without them. They really are oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes sort of the interpreter for the person between the troubleshooter, the problem solver. And that's true for many of us, but it's sort of more so with autism, where the person really understands the individual with autism very well and is able to help describe things in terms for us as researchers that allow us to sort of collate the information and make it very meaningful. Individuals with autism can do this too, but it's really important to work with somebody who understands the person intimately and has known them for years and years. And that's also true when you're doing diagnostic work with somebody who has a neurodevelopmental difference. So if it's autism or ADHD or something like that, it's really important and valuable to get information from somebody else that knows the person well and is able to answer a lot of questions about what they do that might be different than what's typical of other people. And then caregivers are just essential supports to people throughout the lifespan as well.
Psychologist Megan Farrelly focuses on adult diagnostics and research at UW-Madison's Weizmann Center. Madeline Barger is here, therapist and lead behavior analyst with the Weizmann Center Autism Treatment Programs. Call in with a question, share insights, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks to our listener requests, we explore new developments in supportive services for adults with disabilities. Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have psychologist Megan Farley, part of a research team studying aging and autism at UW-Madison's Waisman Center, and Madeline Barger, her colleague, lead behavior analyst with the Waisman Center Autism Treatment Program and a clinic lead for teens and adults. Madeline, you're a licensed marriage and family therapist as well as a certified sex therapist. So how do those areas intersect with the work you do on autism, on the autism treatment program?
Yeah, so the intersection, so a huge part of quality of life for all of us is our relationships, our sex lives, our love lives, and our intimacy. And so what I do is I've adapted a lot of the family therapy and the sex therapy literature and research over the years to be inclusive for people on the spectrum. And there is a lot of benefit, as Megan alluded to before the break, to working with the whole family. So someone on the spectrum developmentally, they may be at home longer with their parents, but in clinical work, we still believe that they are entitled to sexual pleasure and happiness and also partnership. So we work with the whole family per Megan's research to make sure that everybody is on board and understanding what that might look like. And oftentimes we have debunked a lot of myths about sex and relationships and autism.
What is the one that comes up? is there one that rises more than others that you hear more often?
Yeah, so a lot of times we'll hear that a person on the spectrum, a myth might be that they wouldn't be like an understanding or empathic partner, which is simply not true. They're some of the most empathic people you could meet and have different and unique ways of expressing that. Incredible partners to their loved ones. So.
Well, this may or may not be a myth, but is it difficult or more difficult for neurodivergent people to make friends but also grow into intimate relationships?
Certainly, they will share that it's very difficult because a lot of the education from little on and it is set up for maybe more neurotypical thinking in terms of how to make friends and sustain relationships. So we do a lot of sort of backtracking and begin sex education sometimes with adults, but adapted to their needs so that they can really understand what it is that they want and need and how to get that.
Let's bring on a call. Now, Carla is here in Fort Atkinson. Carla, hi.
Hi. I just want to do a huge shout out to St. Coletta School here in Jefferson County. My stepson is autistic and he goes to school there. You know, once the kids leave their high school atmosphere, it's like, what do we do with our children now? And St. Coletta was a big help for us. Andy goes to programming 3 times a week. They pick him up right at the house, and we never have to worry about him there.
Thank you so much, Carla, for sharing that. Megan Farley, you know, looking at that transition from school to adulthood and bringing up their St. Coletta in Jefferson County, what comes up for you?
Well, it always occurs to me that it comes down to the human beings that are involved in someone's life. So there are a lot of really wonderful programs, and it's so great to hear about St. Coletta. I was just making a note of that because people are always asking me, where's a great program? But it does come down to the human beings that are working with someone. So there are some school programs that are fantastic. And, you know, I'd love to go there myself. And then there are programs that are staffed by people who maybe aren't as passionate or don't know as much about a condition or aren't willing to learn. You know, we know how this goes. So so it just varies based on where you live and who the humans are that are going to be involved. And the same thing is true for rural and urban areas. There are pluses and minuses in both places. When I was a faculty in Utah, we did a research study on aging and autism, and it was terrific study and learned that many of the people that were living in rural areas had very robust lives, robust social lives. And I think a lot of the benefit for them came from just really being included in the community and accepted like anybody else would be, given the size of the community and the people there. And then people who are living in urban areas tend to have access to more sort of formal programming. So I think there's a wide variety in the experiences people have, and it comes down to the human beings involved in most cases.
We're talking about neurodiversity on the lifespan with UW-Madison's Waisman Center, Megan Farley, psychologist, Madeline Barger, therapist. You can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Rich in Milwaukee is here. Rich, hello.
Hi.
What would you like to bring up?
I'm just trying to find some resources. I have a niece who has autism who lives in Juliet, Illinois, and she's 18, and the parents are struggling with resources to find help with, you know, they're getting older and she's getting older, and they're looking for places that she could possibly live at in the future, or work at, you know, just resources. And it's real struggle to find anything. I didn't know if you knew of anything in the Juliet area.
Rich, thank you. Madeline, when you hear this type of story, what do you think about it in this scenario?
Yeah, I hear this often. I think often what we think about is the amount of training that we need to be doing as researchers and clinicians so that we can sort of grow that capacity in our region. Different university centers, I know, like the Weissman Center, have resource centers where you can call. And they're, you know, working diligently to expand the resources for adults. And so I'm less familiar with Illinois, but it would be really a good idea to contact a university center in the state and or a university and check out resources that way, because sometimes they just haven't trickled out to the community.
Rich, thank you for the call. Let's bring in Scott in Madison, who is known to Megan and Madeline. Scott, I understand you're also with the Waisman Center.
Well, actually, I'm not with the Waisman Center.
Oh, okay.
I'm with LifeStance Madison, but I am a mental health counselor. I'm on the autism spectrum myself, and I work primarily with fellow autistic adults. And yes, I do consider myself a friend and colleague of Megan and Madeline. And what I wanted to add, in some ways echo some things that have been mentioned, but I want to expand on some of these ideas in terms of, so in my work as a counselor, when I have autistic adults come to me, many of them have had disappointing or even quite negative experiences with prior psychotherapy. And the single most frequent complaint that I hear is that other therapists either aren't equipped for or will not work with them on social skills. And this is, of course, significant because that's one of the main aspects of being autistic. And therefore, that's unsupported. There's not enough training. There's not enough understanding across most therapy options. You know, there are a few people here and there like myself, Megan and Madeline have this understanding, but it's not enough. And what this underscores to me is that autistic adults and people of various other neurodiverse backgrounds, they want connection. They want the social connection, the emotional connection with other people. But the fact is that society around them is still ignorant and often stigmatizing to them and their experiences. So the equation is skewed. You can teach and support the autistic individual, but they still have to live in this uninformed and often prejudicial society. So to me, the support means not only helping the individual understand these things, but helping to change the attitudes and understanding of society in order to make meaningful connection possible.
Yes, Scott, thank you. And we are short on time. Megan Farley, would you like to respond there?
Yeah, hallelujah. That's all I have to say. Scott is always the go-to person to hit the ball out of the park describing the experience and the needs. He's just terrific. I think he did a great job there.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us and shedding some light on this area. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Megan Farley is a psychologist and part of a research team studying aging and autism at the UW-Madison Waisman Center. Madeline Barger, therapist and lead behavior analyst with the Waisman Center Autism Treatment Programs. We continue this conversation ahead, exploring new ways to develop social environments for Wisconsin teens and young adults on the autism spectrum. And you can call in with a question. You can share your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about a new Wisconsin initiative for neurodivergent teens and young adults, creating arts-based activities and guided discussions in six communities through what's called The Fellowship. Call in with a question, share your comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Chris Lofgren is a software engineer in Eau Claire and a participant in the Islands of Brilliance Fellowship Program. Chris, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, Kate. Happy to be here.
Thank you. And Kate Siekman here as well, Director of Learning and Outcomes for Islands of Brilliance. And this is a Milwaukee nonprofit offering learning experiences for children and young adults on the autism spectrum. Kate, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So you co-wrote the curriculum for the fellowship. What, you know, how is this program designed? Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this program was designed directly in response from young adults who we've met at various conferences within our communities in rural and mid-sized Wisconsin communities. And it was really developed as a space where young adults and teens entering their transition age years could really find partnership in each other, find community, and develop some really beautiful skills and art along with each other. So I wrote this program based on the positive youth development perspective, which really supports a strengths-based approach and a community-based approach, supporting citizenship and well-being of youth and young adults.
What is happening, as you call it, in those transition age years that could be better supported through different types of programs like art programming, for instance?
Right. So if we think about all of us as young adults, we all tended to gravitate toward folks who we related to, peers who we related to, who we could really ask those tough questions and live this experience together. And for a lot of autistic young adults, they don't always have that community of support and folks that they can rely on. So that's why we created this curriculum. And we're using art as a medium because over our 11 years of being around in the Milwaukee area, we found that art is that really great, great communicator. It doesn't require spoken word. It just requires that you engage fully and that you explore yourself through artistic expression.
I mean, the focus is on what is something that is happening before you. Maybe your focus and your eyes are on something else, and yet you can still have a conversation with the person next to you who is also working on a similar project.
Absolutely. And really what we've found is that it really demands very little. In a world that has a lot of demands, all it asks is for you to be present and for you to express yourself. So it really gives a voice to folks who don't feel like they always have a voice.
Hmm. Chris, as a participant, what can you tell us? What is an example of a recent activity you did with the program?
Yeah, actually, just yesterday, they split us up into a couple different groups. One group essentially used physical mediums like pencil and paper, markers, and even sometimes googly eyes to create little cities. And then I believe the iPad group in the other section, they used Procreate on the organization-issued iPads mm-hmm. to essentially draw superheroes. And then at the end, we all get together and kind of workshop each other's work like a gallery.
Who have you met at this program? Have you met new people?
Yeah, I'd say so. So some of the folks I recognize from other places across town. Sometimes people drive from further away, but usually the fellowship participants are going to be local to the community where it's actually being hosted.
Does that make it special in some way, knowing that these are the people who are kind of your neighbors and they're around you in this in the larger community, and yet here you are sharing an activity with them?
Yeah, I'd say so, because for those folks who do share those common groups, it's obviously another avenue to explore a different way to create stuff together. And then for the folks who wouldn't have otherwise met me, right, I'm able to kind of see what they're like and maybe learn more about them that way.
I wonder, how did you learn about the fellowship? How did you even discover its existence?
So this particular group has been cross-promoting with the L.E. Phillips Memorial Public Library. And I actually found out about it through their newsletter, among other places.
We're talking with Chris Lofgren, who is a fellowship participant in the Islands of Brilliance program. Kate Siekman co-wrote the curriculum as we look at this new arts programming. Call in with a question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Kate, do participants and fellows have to be formally diagnosed as neurodiverse?
Actually, no. And here's the reason behind that. Through our experience in working with autistic individuals and neurodiverse individuals as that umbrella term, we found some disparities in the diagnostic processes. So if you think about the disparities, I think about a couple of factors. Race being a disparity, it's seen that Black and brown individuals are less likely to be diagnosed formally with autism. We see a disparity in gender. So folks who are born female typically are not diagnosed until much later in life, if at all. And then a socioeconomic status. So we see that folks who are lower income typically can't afford that diagnostic process. So because of those disparities, we don't require a formal diagnosis. We just require that folks identify as neurodiverse and are able to find that community in our programming.
For people who identify as neurodiverse or who do receive a diagnosis of autism in their 20s, in their 30s, in their 40s, even later, what effect might that have on their lives and their relationships and their social fabric? Can you talk further about that, Kate?
I can talk further based on the experiences that I've heard firsthand. But I would say that basically what they're experiencing is this disconnect in identity. So a lot of times when folks are diagnosed later in life, it's actually, I've heard from some that it's validating, because they had always felt like something was different and had a difficult time figuring out why that was. And for that reason, they didn't really receive services prior, those early intervention services or services to support them through their academic journey. So a lot of time those folks are feeling validated, but also lost. Now, what do I do with this diagnosis? What are my resources? So the resources tend to be a lot harder to obtain once you're older if you haven't had a diagnosis prior.
Chris, what do you think about a diagnosis and whether a person can diagnose themselves as neurodiverse and identifying as neurodiverse?
Kate, that's honestly a great question. I'm aware that, a lot of what Dr. Kate says is true. There aren't always a lot of resources available, especially if you live in smaller parts of the state where they just don't necessarily have the funds or resources available to devote to treating and helping neurodiverse folks. And even if those resources are there, I've heard horror stories from friends and other folks about how occasionally they've been even gaslit by the providers who are supposed to be giving them a fair evaluation, particularly because they may feel that because they saw it in a TikTok or something, that it's now some sort of trend to diagnose themselves as autistic or with ADHD or any kind of term under the neurodiverse umbrella. And I think that that makes it incredibly difficult to be able to reach out to folks to get that diagnosis, because if you're already encountering that kind of stigma and you're getting it at the medical offices where you're supposed to be getting care, that can make it a lot harder when you finally receive that diagnosis, if you get it at all. And it's, in working with that, the workplace isn't always accommodating of those kinds of differences.
It's not always supportive. Is that what you're saying as well?
I've heard stories about how people I've worked with, even if they do have a formal ADHD diagnosis and they submit it to their workplace HR, they don't get the proper care or accommodations that they would be entitled to, whether as a formality or under law. And it's led to them not doing as well as they otherwise could have done, or potentially even getting adversely affected in other ways.
Chris Lofgren is a software engineer and a poet in Eau Claire, participating in the local Islands of Brilliance Fellowship program. Kate Siegman is with us, Director of Learning and Outcomes for the Wisconsin organization Islands of Brilliance. You can call in with a question. You can share your perspective along the way at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about a new statewide fellowship program. It's bringing together neurodivergent people in early adulthood through the arts, and it's led by the nonprofit Islands of Brilliance. And programs are underway in 6 Wisconsin communities. We heard from Paul in La Crosse, called in to share that they're an Islands of Brilliance participant, and they said they appreciate the inclusivity of the program. Call in with a question, add your comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Chris Lofgren is a software engineer and is participating in their local Islands of Brilliance Fellowship program. Kate Siegman is here, Director of Learning and Outcomes at Islands of Brilliance. Let's go to Eddie in Madison. Eddie, hi, what would you like to bring up?
Hi, can you hear me?
Sure can.
Oh, hi. My name is Edie. That's
okay. Edie. I'm sorry.
I just wanted to give a shout-out to Goodwill of South Central Wisconsin in Dane County. I am a job coach, and I work for a supported employment program. I'm not sure if a lot of parents know, but we provide independence through the power of work. That's our mission, and we go to job sites and support people with disabilities. I have a lot of clients that have autism, and we support them in their work environment so that they're successful and social. And sometimes they even get to a point where they don't need our support other than checking in on them once in a while. But it's a pretty awesome program. And before I started working for Goodwill, I didn't realize we're not just buying used clothing. We're, you know, the money is used towards supported employment and independent living.
Edie, thank you so much for sharing that about a job coach and the impact at Goodwill. Kate, go ahead. What would you like to share about that and the impact of job coaches?
Yeah, so job coaching is a really important tool that some autistic folks may utilize within their communities. And it really does support the idea that folks with disabilities overall are entitled to employment and are entitled to a supported employment model. I will highlight that not all autistic individuals use job coaching, but I do know that that is a really valuable resource within our communities. So I appreciate Edie for sharing that with everyone.
Carissa, you were talking about a job site that is not supportive or hospitable. What impact do you think could job coaches have?
I think job coaches can be unique in that they could help place folks with positions that may be best suited to their individual needs and talents. I'm not aware of as much of an impact, positive or negative necessarily in the corporate world per se. But I would say that overall they are doing a pretty good service.
Kate, there are 6 fellowship programs operating in different regions of the state. Does each site operate in the same way, or do they have their own uniquenesses?
Oh, that's a really great question. I would say that the activities and the resources available to each site are equal across the board, but each site has such a unique group of folks and a unique culture into its own, which is what has been a really beautiful journey for me to go on through the process of leading this fellowship program, is seeing the cultures that have existed across our sites. While some sites have smaller groups, other sites have larger groups and lots of different subcultures that they have created, which is the best that I could have imagined for this program, really, because we know every community is unique in its own.
And Chris, you participate in the Eau Claire location, and I understand the Eau Claire location has a community of LGBTQ representation, maybe more so compared to other sites. What might be making this location a welcoming place?
I think Eau Claire, because of its positioning both, right next to the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, right there, right? You have a lot of college folks coming in. And even just in general, Eau Claire seems to be one of the nicer communities as far as queer acceptance and whatnot. And so I think that for those reasons, maybe the concentration there of like queer folks versus people who might not identify as such is a bit stronger.
And you are a poet and a member of the local Queer Poetry Guild. How do you feel about expressing that side of yourself with other participants in the fellowship? Or have you offered your poetry through the fellowship?
I haven't offered it through the fellowship yet, but I think poetry at large, as well as the stuff provided, through the fellowship and other opportunities, is essentially a form of storytelling.
Yes.
And storytelling is a very, very strong skill to have in both personal and professional worlds. And I think it can really bring people together in a powerful way.
What impact has poetry had on your life?
I think it's enabled me to process some things, personally that I haven't otherwise really thought through. Because taking experiences and putting them into words or art or other things, that's something that can take time and effort, and it does bring about uncomfortable feelings that you have to like interrogate to kind of figure out why it is that they are that way. But if you're comfortable doing that, I think it's a pretty strong way to do that in combination or sometimes in lieu of professional therapy and other things like that.
Chris Lofgren there is a fellowship participant in Islands of Brilliance as we talk about this new arts program. The program co-written by Kate Siekman, and you can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Carrie in Shorewood is here. Carrie, hello. Hi,
good
Carrie.
Morning.
Yes, good morning.
Hi,
Hi. I just wanted to say I have a nephew in his early 30s on the spectrum, and I didn't know if there was any resource people out there to help with navigating dating and, you know, with texting, with setting up, you know, first dates and things like that. I've watched that show, Love on the Spectrum, it's called, and I've seen that even there was someone that could guide these people with that. Is there anybody like that in Wisconsin?
Carrie, thank you for the call. Kate, did you hear that Carrie is talking about someone in their network in their early 30s and really guiding through that relationship process of forming relationships and intimate partners?
That's a really good question. And as I listened to your previous, the previous guests that mm-hmm, you had on mm-hmm. the show, I know that there are a lot of therapists who take on that topic, but I also have to say there is something to having a supportive network of peers who align with a lot of similar life experiences to help with that navigating the dating world. Our program, Islands of Brilliance, does offer a young adult program where we meet virtually every Friday, and then once a month we go out into the community and participate in really just fun leisure activities. We share a meal, but a lot of our participants in their 20s and 30s have found a community in our Brilliant Breakfast Club program and have found a really supportive network of peers. In addition, some folks find that it's helpful to talk to a therapist who specializes in neurodiversity and relationships. I happen to know there's a therapist out of Madison via an organization called Heart Consulting that does a really phenomenal job and is actually running a free virtual workshop here in March regarding the same topic on relationships and dating for folks who are neurodiverse.
Okay, thank you so much for that insight. Chris and her, just final moments together. I'm wondering if there's anything you would like to further expand on about the fellowship and about Islands of Brilliance.
Yeah, so from what I've heard, it's mostly a weekly gathering. Sometimes that can change for different reasons, but overall, I think it's a really great way to connect with folks. Mm-hmm. Both who you might know and who you might not otherwise have known about.
Yeah.
And just kind of create art together.
Oh,
you know,
I love
tell
that.
Stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, Chris, Kate, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Kate Siekman, Director of Learning and Outcomes for Islands of Brilliance. Chris Lofgren is a software engineer and a poet in Eau Claire participating in their local Islands of Brilliance Fellowship Program. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.